Another guy that people like to psychoanalyze is Osama bin Laden. Bin Laden is repeatedly portrayed as some lunatic who has perverted the true message of Islam to suit his own evil purposes. Operating under the assumption that bin Laden is not motivated by genuine religious conviction, people have felt compelled to search for other reasons to account for his behavior. So what happened to this guy, bin Laden, that led him to become the mastermind terrorist he is today? Is it something in his past? Something in his genes? Searching for answers, the experts have interviewed members of bin Laden's family, tracked down his childhood friends. They've picked the brains of his former teachers. Some have gone so far as to speculate about the size of his penis, assuming, I suppose, that a tall man with a small penis would just naturally want to blow up buildings full of people. They're desperately searching for any environmental or genetic clue that might shed light on what transformed the son of a Saudi billionaire into the evil one. About the only thing they've ruled out so far is the influence of Islam. Even though bin Laden himself has told us repeatedly that Islam is his only influence. None are so blind as those who refuse to see. In 1996, Osama bin Laden issued a now infamous fatwa declaring jihad against the United States. There are English translations of this fatwa on the internet, and if you haven't read the thing yet, then I would strongly urge you to do so. It's truly a remarkable document, in that it gives us a rare look inside the mind of one of the few people on this planet who I think really believes this stuff we find in the Quran. One thing that strikes a reader right off the bat is how thoroughly religious the document is. Bin Laden constantly quotes from the Quran and the Hadith. He even includes excerpts of Islamic poetry. And like it or not, when considered within the framework of Islam itself, his arguments are well thought out, well documented, and for the most part, logically consistent. His words are not the chaotic rantings of some aimless lunatic. Like it or not, Osama bin Laden is not crazy. Islam is crazy. Bin Laden simply appears crazy because he embraces Islam. I want to share with you just a couple of excerpts from bin Laden's fatwa because they reveal how perfectly his message resonates with the core ideology of Islam as we find it in the Quran. In the following passages, bin Laden speaks about the Islamic youth who are willing to become martyrs in the cause of Islam. He writes, and I quote, "These youths love death as you love life. Our youths believe in paradise after death. They believe that taking part in fighting will not bring their day nearer, and staying behind will not postpone the day either. Exalted be to Allah who said, 'And a soul will not die, but with the permission of Allah.' The term is fixed. If death is a predetermined must, then it is a shame to die cowardly. Those who do not die by the sword will die by some other reason. Many causes are there, but one death." Unquote. Can you see his logic here? Bin Laden is telling these kids, look, you're going to die anyway. We all are. That's unavoidable. Now, since you're going to die anyway, why not choose the way you're going to die? And if you can choose the way you're going to die, then why not die the martyr's death? Since the rewards for martyrdom are so great. And what are those rewards? Well, bin Laden continues, quote, "A martyr's privileges are guaranteed by Allah. Forgiveness with the first gush of his blood. He will be shown his seat in paradise. He will be decorated with the jewels of belief. Married off to the beautiful ones. Protected from the test in the grave. Assured security in the day of judgment. Crowned with the crown of dignity, a ruby which is better than this whole world and its entire content. Wedded to 72 of the pure beautiful ones of paradise. And his intercession on the behalf of 70 of his relatives will be accepted." Unquote. Can you see what's happening here? Bin Laden is dangling this big juicy carrot in front of these Muslim kids. But make no mistake, this is not the first time these kids have heard about this carrot. Bin Laden is not making this stuff up as he goes along. He is simply reminding these kids of things they've been taught their whole lives. Everything Bin Laden is telling these kids, from the eternal paradise that awaits martyrs, to the Muslims' duty to resist and to even destroy the infidel, these ideas resonate perfectly with the three real pillars. So when people suggest that Bin Laden has hijacked and perverted the teachings of Islam, the truth is just the opposite. Bin Laden isn't perverting Islam, he's revealing it. And this is what scares me. If Bin Laden was coming totally out of left field with his ideas, our situation would be very different. If that was the case, then we could just round up these nutty terrorists, throw them off the end of the planet, and our problem would be solved. But Bin Laden's rhetoric does not come out of left field. It comes straight out of the Quran. What the spin doctors and pundits like to call fundamentalist Islam is Islam. Yet we just don't seem willing to come to terms with that, do we? We don't hesitate to see the evil in a guy like Bin Laden, but we refuse to see the evil in Islam. In fact, we praise Islam and even encourage its growth. We are, in effect, throwing fuel on the very fires that burn us. This is no way to win a war on terror. Muslims will no doubt find this kind of talk grossly offensive. But I would ask the Muslim this. Why are you so offended when Bin Laden says that he will kill the infidels, but you are not offended when you read those very same words in your Quran? And why are you offended when Bin Laden gloats over U.S. civilians being incinerated by the fires of exploding jet fuel on 9/11? But you are not offended when your Quran tells us in the most graphic language imaginable how unbelievers like myself will be tortured in the fires of hell for all eternity. I would ask the Muslim, why the double standard? Here's an idea. Why don't we do this instead? Why don't we decide what behaviors we will deem abhorrent and then condemn those behaviors wherever we find them practiced or wherever we find them promoted, and regardless of who it is that's practicing them or promoting them, whether it be Osama bin Laden or Jerry Falwell or Hitler or Almighty God. Here we are at the dawn of the 21st century. Why don't we adopt a new approach to morality? An approach that views morality not as a function of blind obedience to the whims of some imaginary tyrant, but instead as a function of principles that are rooted in a value for real human beings. The human family is in need of this kind of moral clarity now more than ever before. The stakes are just too high. Today, we live in a world of nuclear and chemical weapons. We live in a world where people are driven by a toxic blend of desperation and dogma to blow themselves up in shopping malls. We live in a world in which our most popular religions teach us that the end of the world will only usher in the beginning of paradise. What we have here is a lethal mixture of weapons of mass destruction and popular ideologies that promote the worship of a terrorist. This is a recipe for disaster. What can be done about this depressing state of affairs? Well, on the ideological front at least, I would submit to you that our problems stem from the three real pillars. Assuming the three real pillars are at the root of the problem, then perhaps a solution can be found by considering the antithesis of the three real pillars, their opposite. Let's try this, starting with real pillar number one. In a general sense, real pillar number one states that there is a God, and only one God, and that this one God speaks to mankind through prophets. This monotheistic belief that there exists a God who rules the universe necessarily reduces man to a second-class citizen in the universe, and a very distant second class at that. God is on top. Man is on bottom. God is supremely important and valuable. Man is expendable and essentially worthless. This worldview has disturbing moral implications. In the context of real pillar number one, morality is reduced to unquestioned obedience to God. This is submission, plain and simple. Obey God or else. And obey God even if what God commands you to do strikes you personally as morally repugnant. This principle is graphically illustrated in the story of Abraham and Isaac as found in Genesis chapter 22. In this story, God, just out of the blue, tells Abraham to offer up his son Isaac as a burnt offering. In other words, God was telling Abraham to kill his son. And this was to be no ordinary killing. The burnt offering would require Abraham to cut off Isaac's head, tear the skin off his body, chop him up in little pieces, and then barbecue the gory mess on a stone altar. Clearly, this was not something Abraham was looking forward to. Abraham loved Isaac. The Bible makes that clear. But what choice did Abraham have? Here was God, the King of the universe, ordering him to do it. So Abraham obeyed God, and he did so without question. Now, in all fairness, God did stop Abraham at the very last second. But that's not the point. We've already seen that God is not above ordering his people to murder children. The point here is that in the eyes of monotheism, morality is a function of blind obedience to God. Ponder for just a moment that Abraham's willingness to obey God in all things, even to the point of murdering his own son, is an attitude that is actually celebrated by Jews, Christians, and Muslims. I find that a bit scary. The story of Abraham and Isaac is, in a word, disgusting. But it reveals the unavoidable consequence of basing one's morality on obedience to God. And it reveals something else. It illustrates that nobody, in his right mind, would engage in such vicious and stupid behavior unless God was commanding him to do it. Remove this God from our thinking, and in one fell swoop, we remove all motivation to kill in the name of God. Remove God from our thinking, and gone is the chief motivation behind every religious war ever fought. Remove God from our thinking, and all we have left is man. With real pillar number one removed, the edifice of monotheism, along with all of its ugly moral implications, comes crashing to the ground. With the old paradigm raised, we are now free to construct a whole new moral paradigm, one rooted in a value for man. There are two parts of real pillar number one, the part about God and the part about prophets. The second part asserts that God doesn't speak to just anyone. Instead, he speaks to specially selected men called prophets. Moreover, God has spoken to only a handful of these prophets throughout all of history. When God speaks to a prophet, it's called revelation. One of our country's founding fathers, a guy named Thomas Paine, wrote a book called The Age of Reason. In his book, Paine makes an important observation about the nature of revelation. Paine writes, and I quote, "It is a contradiction in terms and ideas to call anything a revelation that comes to us at second hand, either verbally or in writing. Revelation is necessarily limited to the first communication. After this, it is only an account of something which that person says was a revelation made to him. And though he may find himself obliged to believe it, it cannot be incumbent upon me to believe it in the same manner. For it was not a revelation made to me, and I have only his word for it that it was made to him." When Moses told the children of Israel that he had received the two tables of the commandments from the hands of God, they were not obliged to believe him, because they had no other authority for it than his telling them so. And I have no other authority for it than some historian telling me so. When I am told that the Quran was written in heaven and brought to Muhammad by an angel, the account comes too near the same kind of hearsay evidence and second-hand authority as the former. I did not see the angel myself, and therefore, I have a right not to believe it. End of quote. Payne correctly points out here that if some guy claims to have received a revelation from God, that I am under no obligation to believe it. Naturally, should God someday decide to speak to me personally, instead of through one of these long-dead prophets, then I'll be more than happy to believe. In the meantime, however, I'm going to keep my options open. I'm going to continue with my questioning and my searching and my doubting, especially when it comes to the claims of religion. In short, I'm going to keep thinking. The operative word here is think. When a person decides to follow a Moses or a Jesus or a Muhammad, the person has effectively performed an abortion on the thinking process. He sacrifices his own thoughts in order to accommodate the teachings of his prophet. He literally stops thinking for himself. Now, this doesn't mean the person stops thinking about everything. He may think very intensely about business or politics or music or getting laid, but when it comes to religion, all the questioning and doubting and challenging comes to a halt. When it comes to religion, that screensaver of the mind is always on. There's a word for this act of intellectual suicide. The word is submission. We've already seen that the word Islam is an Arabic word that literally means submission. The Christian world has its own version of submission. It's called giving your life to Jesus. In the most general sense, it's called worship. But whatever you want to call it, the act is one of subordinating one's own thoughts to the thoughts of another. Just like Abraham subordinated his love for Isaac to the dictates of God. All of this thoughtless nonsense is a product of embracing real pillar number one. Remove real pillar number one. Remove this presumption that God speaks through prophets. And maybe, just maybe, people will start thinking for themselves. And who knows? If people start thinking for themselves, then maybe, just maybe, when they read in their holy books tales of genocide and hellish tortures, they will no longer call these things good. Let's move on to real pillar number two. Real pillar number two tells us that after death, all human beings will live forever in either paradise or hell. Remove pillar number two from our thinking, and in one fell swoop, we eliminate all incentive to fly jumbo jets into buildings in hopes of securing a reward in the afterlife. But it does far more than just that. With real pillar number two out of the way, we are free to view human life as a finite thing. Life becomes a precious, limited resource, and a value for this precious, limited resource can serve as the foundation for a very useful system of moral principles. For example, using this value for life as our standard, we can see why the taking of life through an act of murder would be wrong, even an atrocity. But this same standard of life also tells us why an act of self-defense would be justifiable. It's done to protect this limited resource that we call life. Viewing life as a limited resource also enables us to show why theft is wrong. When a person acquires property, he typically pays for it with money. He earns the money by giving up some of his time and effort in the form of work. So in the final analysis, the person is really giving up part of his life. He's giving up a measurable amount of this limited resource we call life in exchange for property. So when the thief robs a person of his property, the thief has, in a very real way, taken from his victim part of his life. This standard of life also tells us why the stoning of a Sabbath breaker is really an act of murder, even though the Bible portrays it as an act of justice. Likewise, it tells us why acts of terrorism are wrong. Acts of terrorism simply cannot be justified when we use a value for human life as our moral standard. By contrast, acts of terrorism are easily justified in a system that places more value in God than it does in people, and more value in the next life than it does in this one. Consider too the principles of personal liberty, freedom of speech, freedom of religion. These principles are nowhere to be found in the Quran or the Bible. We had to come up with these all by ourselves. Before moving on to real pillar number 3, I want to briefly address a concern that many people have about societies that abandon a belief in God and the afterlife. Conventional wisdom seems to assume that if we abandon our religious beliefs, that our free society will automatically collapse into a socialistic tyranny similar to those of Hitler and Stalin. This attitude totally misses the mark. Abandoning a belief in God does not lead to tyranny. Tyranny is what you get when human beings are subordinated in value to some other entity. And that entity can be a tyrant, it can be the state, or it can be a god. The devaluing of the individual is what leads to tyranny. And nowhere do we find the individual devalued more than we do in the pages of the Bible and the Quran. But we must believe in an afterlife, we are told. We need the afterlife to settle the moral books. Without an afterlife in which to punish evildoers, people like Hitler will have gotten away with their atrocities, or so we are told. I have two things I'd like to say about this. First, let's remind ourselves of what happened during Hitler's regime. Among other things, 6 million Jews were killed. 6 million human beings murdered. Folks, let's stop kidding ourselves. Hitler did get away with it. Stalin got away with it. Mao got away with it. The terrorists of 9/11 got away with it. The damage is done. We ought not allow an irrational belief in some afterlife to make us feel better about the fates of these victims. We need to let these atrocities enrage us and then move us to action to prevent such things from happening again in the future. Because one thing is for sure, God is not going to stop these people. Thinking that all the scores will be settled in some imaginary afterlife is a desperate wish. And it's counterproductive to the extent that we push our moral responsibilities onto some invisible God and into some imaginary afterlife. And one more thing. What makes us think that any scores are going to be settled in the afterlife? Ponder for a moment that according to both Islam and Christianity, the Jews who suffered so horrifically at the hands of the Nazis are now burning in hell. They have simply gone from Hitler's ovens to God's ovens. Talk about out of the frying pan and into the fire. That's not justice in my book. But in the holy books of Christianity and Islam, that is justice. And it gets worse. According to people like Jerry Falwell, what gets you into heaven is not your behavior, but whether you have accepted Jesus Christ as your personal Savior. Perhaps you remember the case of Carla Faye Tucker. Carla Faye Tucker was an axe murderer on death row who found Jesus while in prison. Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson made headlines when they lobbied to have Carla Faye Tucker's sentence commuted from the death penalty to life in prison. It didn't work. But in the process, they did manage to transform this axe murderer into a sort of modern Christian folk hero. And why? Because Carla Faye had given her life to Jesus. She had become a bona fide, washed in the blood of Christ Christian, and now she's going to heaven. That's right. This axe murderer is going to heaven. Jewish families murdered during the Holocaust are burning like French fries in hell. But this axe murderer is going to heaven. Heck, under the Christian system of justice, had Hitler accepted Jesus before he died, he'd be in heaven too. And who knows? Maybe Hitler did accept Jesus. The point I want to make here, basically, is that embracing pillars 1 and 2 will not satisfy our longing for moral understanding or justice. In fact, more often than not, they only rob us of these things. On to real pillar number 3, which tells us that the only way a person can get into paradise and stay out of hell is to die a good Muslim. Now, we can easily expand this pillar to include Christianity, since Jesus tells his disciples in Mark 16, verse 16, that unbelievers will be condemned. Same principle, different religion. By ridding ourselves of real pillar number 3, We can no longer condemn our fellow human beings on the basis of what some prophet is alleged to have said thousands of years ago. We also rid ourselves of the irrational anxiety that comes from believing in a God who would actually torture people forever in hell. Incidentally, if you happen to be one of these people who worries that you may end up going to hell if you don't belong to the right religion, consider this unavoidable fact. No matter what your religion, someone, somewhere, believes you're going to hell. You simply can't escape it. If you're a Christian, the Muslims think you're going to hell. If you're a Muslim, the Christians think you're going to hell. If you're a Jew or Buddhist or atheist like I am, then both the Christians and the Muslims think you're going to hell. No matter how hard you try, you just can't avoid being condemned to hell by someone's religion. So you may as well just throw caution to the wind, think what you want to think, and let the chips fall where they may. And if some self-righteous religious do-gooder scolds you for believing the wrong things, just do what I do. Tell him he can go to hell.